Man, what a great day to be gathered together with our brothers and sisters, with the people of God, and a great morning of worship. So appreciated. Tommy's leading us in our singing and for the great thoughts that Rob shared. And just been a really good morning so far. And I am thankful to be with you, thankful to be back with you. We were gone for a little bit, and it's good to be back. I enjoyed our week away. We certainly enjoyed getting to celebrate with the Markrams, but it's better to be here away from them. It's good, better to be here with you and there with you. We're thankful for our brothers and sisters and for all the great life accomplishments. Our teens are back. They got back last night from Give Kids the World Village. Now, you may or may not know about this. This is a great picture that our own professional photographer, Heather Tucker, took. Our teens spent the week down serving the families of kids who are battling some life-altering illnesses and diseases and injuries. Our kids go down and they work in this setting, in this Give Kids the World Village, and they don't pass out. Our kids don't pass out life-altering medicine. They don't perform any serious surgeries this year that I know of, but their work makes a difference nonetheless. The goal of this mission trip is to provide moments of happiness, snippets of joy and elation. It is a place of temporary repose from a weary world. You know, sometimes I think we underestimate the value of that sort of work, not just in mission trips for our teens, but in our daily lives, in our daily living. I think we underestimate that. It can be easy to dismiss its importance, but it feels so little when you compare it with the problems of this world, right? I mean, we look out at all that's wrong with our world, and there's a lot of things we can point to. You know, families disintegrating and our society's falling apart, and there's underpayment of the poor and the rich siphoning off that wealth, and we've got, at the same time, we've got fraud and we've got diseases that are run rampant, and we've got corrupt governments, and I mean, there's just all these big problems, you know, drought and war and famine, and I mean, there's these big problems facing the world. What does it matter, this little bit of tiny temporariness that I do? Several years ago, I decided to try my hand at growing a vegetable garden. It's not it. I looked for a picture of my garden, and I could not find it, but you're just going to have to take my word that this is a lot nicer than my garden ever looked. But we did it. We grew, tilled up the ground, and then I dug up a little area, built a little raised bed, cobbled together a compost bin, and used some leaves and things, and started making compost, and I invited some neighbors to join in, and a couple of them actually did. And we actually produced a little garden. There was some garlic and some okra and some squash and some cucumbers and maybe some other things that I'm not remembering, but I remember those. And no doubt, those of you who are gardeners, your gardens right now, they're in full swing, and you're well aware of how much work it is to have a vegetable garden. Not just to do one, but to actually have it. But it was a bit of a learning curve for me, because I was really hoping that all that hard work I did up front, and I did a lot of hard work up front. I think even my wife would testify I worked hard on that up front. But I was hoping it was one of those work hard up front and then you're done sort of experiences. You just reap the harvest. But that was not to be. And as we continue our study through the book of Galatians, we're nearing the end now. We're in chapter 6. And the Apostle Paul starts talking a little bit about that analogy of like growing a garden, growing a vegetable garden or raising your food or planning for a harvest, and what that has to do with our everyday Christian living. And he talks about sowing to please the flesh versus sowing to please the spirit. And I think sometimes we've read these verses and maybe gotten the wrong idea about what Paul was talking about there. So let's just read it in the context, and then we'll talk about it a little bit. Galatians chapter 6, beginning at verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please the flesh, from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Sowing and reaping, sowing and reaping. It was the most natural metaphors, especially in an agrarian society, a society that's built around agriculture, or a society where the majority of the people grew their own food. At one time, we were predominantly an agrarian-based society early in the history of our country. We've long since kind of deviated from that, and most of our food now is handled by factories, right? They produce the meat, they produce the wheat, they produce the corn, they produce the... You go out and you see most of the crops that are grown in our area are not just like, this is not a family growing their own 1,000 acres of soybeans because they just really love soybeans, right? Most of the crops that are grown in our area are done for commercial purposes, but it was not that way at one time. One time, families were like, this is my plot of land, and I'm going to grow enough to feed my family, and I'm going to try to grow enough that maybe I can trade with so-and-so who grows something else that I need, and that'll be about it. But we have to remember that in the context that Paul is writing, when he's writing to these churches in Galatia, he is urging these newer Christians to avoid the teachings of some specific teachers, these Judaizing missionaries. And he says, I want you to not listen to them who are urging you to go back to keeping the law of Moses, and I want you to stick with your life by the Spirit. And he's saying, look, you don't need to keep the Jewish law, and you don't need to be a biological descendant of Abraham in order to be right with God. In fact, Paul argues, if you pay only attention to what you're saying to what they're saying to you, you're just paying attention to the flesh. You're worried about your biological descendants. You're worried about, you know, circumcision, fleshly circumcision, about the food that you eat, you know, which is clean, which is not clean. You're just worried about all these outward things, what you touch, what you taste, what you smell, what your bloodline is, the way that you look. And if you just pay attention to these outside things, you are just sowing to please the flesh. And the problem with that is not that those aren't good things to do. The problem is that your flesh dies. My flesh dies. All flesh dies. So if you are sowing to please the flesh, you are going to reap what the flesh gets. And as healthy as I may be, and I'm healthy as a horse, ladies and gentlemen, but one of these days I'm going to die and I'm just going to be dust. And you too. So if we are sowing to please the flesh, no matter how great a job we do, one day that's all going to dry up and blow away. That's sowing to the flesh and reaping destruction. And think about the consequences and divisiveness of this teaching. He's talking about destruction not just in the flesh dies sort of way, but all the problems this sort of teaching would have created in their Christianity and specifically in these churches. If you start shunning everyone who is grappling with sin, because one, they're not as good as you, and because two, you're afraid that if you get too close to them, it might somehow taint you, rub off on you. If you're worried about the flesh, that's exactly what you'll do. You'll avoid the sinners because you don't want to get too close. It would produce arrogant leadership that looked down on those who weren't able to do now what it took me years to be able to do. Because I'm more spiritual than you, and you can't do what I can do, so it creates this air of divisiveness there. It starts comparing your righteousness to the righteousness of others and disdaining all of those who don't agree with your understanding and your interpretation 100%. In fact, he talks a lot about taking care of teachers just in verse 6, just prior to this, because that's exactly seems to be what was going on in these churches in Galatia, was they had some teachers that didn't agree with these Judaizing missionaries, and the people stopped paying them. So if you don't agree with my interpretation, I'm going to stop paying the teachers. He's like, no, you got to pay your teachers. But that's what happens when you start paying attention to the flesh. You get an air of divisiveness and division. And it would be really tempting to sort of consign these to the first century problems of the church. But the truth is, those same issues still plague us and the church of today. In fact, we in Churches of Christ have a pretty unique history with these sorts of problems. Not only are we not immune, we might be particularly vulnerable to these problems because of our historical emphasis on baptism, which is a great thing, but it's a one-time act of righteousness. And so in some ways, we've struggled more because some people, just getting the first slice of cake, start thinking, and this is really tempting, I come from Christian family, I've got Christian parents, I've got Christian grandparents, and I've been baptized, and I go to the right church, so I'm good. And that's all they get. There is no walk with Christ. There's like what I did. I've done the acts of the flesh. I come from the right people. I've done the right things, and so now I'm good. So much so that someone who comes from the right family and who has done the right things and who goes to the right church seems to be in better standing than someone who goes to the wrong church, comes from the wrong family, and is wrestling daily with both God and sin and trying to come to grips with that, and they're sort of on the fringe, if accepted at all. So we have our own problems. That's certainly not to say that other churches in our community don't struggle with this as well. But we have our own set of problems with these same issues. So instead of getting caught up in the flesh trap, Paul argues, he urges the Galatians to sow to please the Spirit. And that just sounds good. That sounds so much better. I mean, if you grew up in churches, you know, should you choose flesh or spirit? I remember being a little kid, and I was thinking, boy, these both sound good to me, flesh and spirit. Jesus said something about flesh being good, and we ought to take his flesh, so that would be good, and we ought to get his spirit, and that would be good too. And I was really debating, but I grew up and I learned flesh is bad, spirit is good. It's sort of like the old adage, if you're ever confused about what the right answer is in Bible class, the right answer is Jesus. Well, in a battle of flesh and spirit, we know that the answer is spirit, right? We probably heard that a bunch. Of course the spirit's the right way to go. But what does that mean? Sow to the Spirit. Well, fortunately, Paul follows up in this analogy by telling us exactly what it means to sow to please the Spirit. And Paul says, it's doing good. If you want to sow to please the Spirit, do good. And a little bit of interpretation here, he means good works, like doing good to everyone we meet, like kindness, like service, like consideration for others. The acts of the Spirit he's talking about here are not piety and going to church on Sunday and praying before you go to bed and saying a prayer before the meal and avoiding the dances at schools or whatever it is you think are acts of piety. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about doing good to other people. But almost immediately, we can come up with some objections. In the spring of 1897, I was just a kid, but Thomas Hanna was a 25-year-old preacher, and he fell out of his carriage, and he landed on his head. And when he woke up, he was in a total state of amnesia. And this doctor, his name is Dr. Boris Sidis. He's a pretty famous American psychologist. He was a genius. I mean, Dr. Sidis and his assistant, Dr. Goodhart, had to teach him how to talk, how to eat, how to go to the bathroom, just like he was a little kid. And so they would take him to the theater, they would take him to the zoo, and they took him to dinner to eat with his family. And for months, they labored with jogging this guy's memory to sort of recreate his pre-accident life. And Dr. Sidis, by the way, brilliant figure in American psychology. He was accepted into Harvard at the age of 9. Brilliant guy. And so, thanks to his brilliance, one day they actually broke through. They had Hannah experienced a moment of crisis, and in that moment of crisis, the past and the present sort of all came together, and his memory was restored, and he recovered completely. And Dr. Sidus became really famous for his success with this patient. Now, the element of surprise in this true story is that Dr. Sidus was one of the most famous atheists of his day. He was a genius, true, but he was an atheist. And if you read about his life, you find out a lot of that genius kind of went to waste. He didn't always use it in the most productive ways. But the point is that he, as an atheist, did good for this Christian preacher who goes on to preach the gospel. And God can use some of the most unlikely instruments for good in this world, right? In Paul's life, there were Roman soldiers that God used to help him. These pagan Roman soldiers helped Paul to accomplish his mission. Atheists do good. Pagans do good. Anybody could be an instrument for doing good in this world. It is not limited to Christians, and we don't have a monopoly on doing good. So if anybody can do good, what's to distinguish us from everybody else? That's what I want to know. What's the point in me being good and doing good when anybody can do good? God, you can use these people living in sin down there to do good, and you can use this person that's an avowed God-hater down there to do good. And so if anybody can do good, what's the use in me doing good? And we tend to write it off there. Therefore, good, just doing good, that's real superficial. That's real inconsequential. That's not spiritual stuff because anybody can do it. And so we miss the chance to communicate with the world on the level, the language, the one language that everyone in the world speaks is the language of good. That's the sort of good Paul's talking about. And we think, well, we've got to do something better. We've got to just do something different than them. We've got to do something spectacular. We've got to do something unusual. We're like the sports team that thinks the only way we can win is to be really, really clever or really tricky. But the truth is that no team ever wins without getting back to the basics. And what Paul's saying here is doing good is like the ABC's foundation of living the successful Christian life. That good works, these good works, they're not meant to save you, but that you cannot be saved apart from doing good works, because good works are the natural result of a heart that is good with God. We aren't out doing good works so that we can become right with God, but that we cannot help but do good works because our hearts are right with God. That's the sort of good works he's doing in our spiritual garden process. It is the work that follows the planting, the work that I sort of hated in gardening. It's the daily work. It's the tending and the weeding and the watering and the feeding. It's the pruning and the protection and picking them up after storms and picking the fruit when the time is just right. I mean, it is that daily labor. You can plant the best garden in the world, and you can have everything looking so pretty, but if you don't take care of that garden, you're going to end up with a hot mess. This doing good is the daily work of that. And we continue with those mundane tasks, that doing good, because we know that what we have sown is sown in the Spirit of God, and so the harvest is worth working for. Brothers and sisters, these little acts of good, it's doing good to your coworkers. And I'm going to just really stress that today, your coworkers, because we don't maybe talk about this enough, but that is a great point of access for you to do good. Sometimes it's hard to know what the right thing is. I mean, should you cover up for someone's mistakes to keep them from being fired when they're truly incompetent? I don't know the right answer to that. But we are to be people who find ways to do good. Because good works are the result of our heart that is good with God. It's doing good for the people we work with. It's doing good for the people we live with. It's listening to what they're struggling with and finding creative ways to serve them. Sometimes it's praying without them knowing. Sometimes it's just bringing an extra sandwich at lunch. Sometimes it's offering to take their kids to the ball game. Sometimes it's, who knows? Find ways to do good. And yes, It is true that anybody can do it, but I'm going to let you in on a little bit of secret here. You are different than everybody else. Because unlike everybody else, as a child of God, you were created for this. You were made for this. You have been given the Spirit of God and an ability to do this beyond what just anybody can do. As a child of God, this is not your job. It is your identity. You are the person who does good. May God bless you this week as we endeavor to sow to please the Spirit, as we seek to do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. May God add his blessing to the study of this word. If we can help you in any way this morning, whether it is prayers for encouragement, for direction, for strength, for forgiveness, or to become a child of God who leads you to a life like this, a life that is rich and is full and it is empowered to do good in the world in which we live. If there's anything we can do for you this morning, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?